Because this talk ends the series for this year on the heart, the movement of the heart in practice. But I ended last year with a series on the heart, and I'll probably end next year with a series on the heart, because I really think it closes off the year very nicely in a gentle way. And it also reorients us. We can get so mind-driven in this business, so sort of self-determined, you know, to catch everything and to be the perfect yogi, that we forget the softer side of the practice, the side of just being gentle with ourselves and being more inclusive and just... It's the easier, more embracing side of the practice. So tonight, the title of the talk is called The Inclusive Heart. And I hope that we really do see how important this total embrace of life is through this talk. In fact, if there's a word that the Dharma rests upon, I would say it was inclusivity, inclusiveness. Now, I mean, I want to keep reinforcing a spiritual logic that could save you from lots of traps that are in the practice and groups and tools that you might use. To simply reframe the issue as to whether the group I'm in or the practice I'm engaged in is inclusive. Because how can you get to one if you're divided in intent and intention with something, or that you separate something out? So, like, for instance, our practice. Yes, we have to separate something out from time to time in order to steady the mind, in order to station our mind upon a particular object so that it settles out and begins to develop some repose and some steadiness. But we don't stay there. We move out. We bring our awareness and attention to the entire range and proliferation of mind to see what it's doing, to develop a relationship with it, to understand it, to be inclusive and heartfelt towards the whole embrace of the mind and body experience, not just one facet of it. So just through that spiritual logic, begin to see, you can begin to get a sense of where practices lie on inclusivity or exclusivity. Whether this practice or the practice you're doing or the practice you may hear from another teacher, eventually allows for the complete understanding of the mind and body and the world at large and the laws that rule this world and this life, and whether you can see yourself growing in a much more fully embracing way. It's especially important to apply that word, I think, when you're in groups or sanghas, because you will automatically negate any cults or personality-focused groups if they become exclusive, which all of them do. And believe me, there are slippery slopes, and many of them out there, in which the group or the sangha begins to form around the personality cult of the teacher. And in some ways, each of those groups makes it difficult to leave, so that you don't have a feeling of a swinging door, that you can come or go as you wish, but that somehow you're sort of locked in to a kind of entry only. And from time to time, if you ever find yourself in that situation, and yet it might be that you're being fed in a certain way, it's always good to discern and just say, is this group inclusive or exclusive? Is it inclusive? Does it ask only certain people to come? Are there any conditions for me to come or go as I wish? Is it fully embracing all people without any conditioned the conditions set for anyone that might enter. And so you really get a sense of, I mean, if it's the Dharma, it's got to go this way. It's got to be more and more wide-ranged and open. So let that be just a general gauge for you in your practices, in the groups, in your orientation, and in how the Dharma is, if you want to see growth in yourself, that growth will be in that direction, towards more tolerance, towards being open to things that you might not have been before. See, reactivity, by definition, is that we have cut ourselves into a single grooved response to something. We're not open to it being what it is, we're reacting to it. We're arguing with it. And if this practice isn't working so that we are moving beyond that reactivity and that we are more settled with life, that we are more adjusted to the different experiences within life, then we'd have to ask whether we're using the practice in a wise way. And you can be sitting in a group that's inclusive. The teacher and the practice you do might be inclusive, but we could still be using it in an unwise way. And so you have to just look and get a sense of how we're growing in relationship to the practices we're using. Whether your heart is becoming more fully available to life, not backing away or distancing or detaching ourselves, some kind of a remote outpost to living, but whether we're fully embracing life, whether it really feels as if we're being affected more and more by life. And that's the inclusive heart. And we know by that general direction that we are practicing in accordance with the tradition as it's truly meant to be practiced. It's a central theme, and I really want each of us to gauge our practice in accordance with that thing. So, because what we do is that we're making our mind and body conscious. We have to see it. We have to include it. When we just respond to the rote memorization or conditioning of our past, we're not really seeing it. It's just dominoes falling. And our whole mind and body experience can be just hooked up into that sequential movement of one conditioned response after another. So to interrupt that flow, we have to look, we have to see, and we know that we're seeing because we realize that what we're seeing, we see it. Again, it's just spiritual logic. You know, do you see what it is that, where you're contracted, where you resist, where we're resisting? Where we're resisting is where the mind is placing a big no, the no of the mind, to the experience of life as it's being presented. That's what resistance is. It's deciding unconsciously that we can improve upon this situation through our own internal control. And that creates thought. That resistance, that rub between the presentation of life and our objection to it is where thought comes in. And thought has to do with the disagreement we have over who really owns this life, God or myself. And that disagreement between God and myself is what thought is. Thought is the squabbling along those demarcation lines in which we are no longer accepting life to be what it is. And eliminating resistance is what the Dharma is all about, is it not? And we could only eliminate resistance when we know where it is that we are resisting, when we are bringing conscious awareness to those areas. So the practice is to constantly be on the alert for any internal arguments with life, because that's where we're being unconscious to life, and that's simply needs our conscious attention to those points of unconscious inattention for us to open those and become more and more inclusive and more settled. Once we're more inclusive, we become more settled. Once we become more settled, we become quieter because there isn't as much argument or thought regarding the resistance that to life. And we're settled because we're not taking arms against what is being presented, and therefore we're more content. You see how it works? And all of it is because we have been willing to look at where it is that we have been so determined in our objection, in our argument. And so this sense of boundaries, of eliminating boundaries, is very, very important to meditation. And anywhere that we cast or create a boundary, there's some level of unconscious attention and contraction being communicated at that boundary line, at that perimeter. And we need to observe it. So that's the reason that the practice needs to go out and start looking at all these various areas of discord. Because it can't just stay on the breath. How are you going to understand where it is that we're having difficulty if you just stay on the breath? You see? Just use your spiritual logic here. People, I want you to get so smart that you can leave here never having to tune me in again and just go with, you know, and just know, have this basic sense in yourself whether this is true or not. Because you have the alignment necessary to make that assertion. Now, it's very interesting. I love speaking about the inclusive heart because, and I love speaking about opening, this continued sense of open embrace that we offer life. Because love does move to erase boundaries. But does that mean that love does not also set boundaries? Sounds paradoxical, doesn't it? How can a practice that is only has one direct, an overriding issue, which is opening more and more and more to life, how could that, in one way, also be restated to say that we also need to set boundaries? Because it's the paradox of the limits and the limitless. And this requires the true coming forth of your heart, of our hearts. Yes, the overall, if you plotted the journey from beginning to end, you would see more and more inclusivity all along the way. And if you took a section of that journey and started exploring it, you would find a lot of backtracking and retreating and just moving backward into self-protection. And it's very important to understand that the journey is not a straight line for most of us, straight line from being contracted to being completely open-ended, and it's a linear approach, and there's no backtracking along the way. There is backtracking along the way. And that's the heart that backtracks. We don't get from point A to point B in a linear line. We get there in a jagged line. And each retreat is as skillful as an advance. Taking care of yourself, knowing what your limits are, and not trying to shove ourselves beyond those limits. Being patient with ourselves when we are stubbornly in disagreement with something. And we see it. We see the stubbornness, we see the disagreement, we see the edge that we're on, we see the resistance that we have, and there's not a thing we can do about it. To try to push ourselves forward is not the heart, that's the mind. It says, no, this should not be here, I'm moving on. The heart doesn't approach its growth in that way. It approaches its growth with patience with inclusivity. It can sit here and wait. It can open and look at where the objection is occurring. It can be patient with the process of learning sufficiently so that we can move forward instead of moving backward. But the wisdom of retreating, of going backward into ourself, is a very important quality of practice to acknowledge. If you think there's just one way to go in this thing, and the quicker you get there, the better, and all of that, you won't take into account your limitations. And to take into account our limitations is to take into account everything that's important on the practice. For this is not your journey. It's the heart's journey. And if you make it your journey, you will whip yourself into shape, but you won't get there. The heart's journey has its own pace and its own timing, and it is not according to your clock time. That's why the Buddha said that patience is the surest form of devotion, the purest form of devotion, I think he said. Because it requires us to release our own timing and to have faith that something else is working here besides our need to master the situation. And we begin to hear how the mind works and how the heart works. We understand, we begin to get a sense of what is it that's controlling this journey and which organ is in control moment after moment. Because the way it works, the way we get through something with this patience is just with the intention that we want to see something. That's what we can do for our journey, is be honest and with a clear orientation to wanting to see the problem, establishing that aspiration, that intention, to really wanting to see where it is that we're bound, where it is that we're contracted. But within that wanting to see, giving the time over to the heart. Okay, so I wasn't able to see very much in that particular anger explosion. Okay, that's all right. I still want to see it. I still want to get to the bottom of this particular reactive pattern. And I'll be patient with it as long as it takes. And as that rises again, that intentionality to be patient and to see, that's all. We begin to bring forth that awareness during those moments of inward crisis. And we begin to understand what it is that's going on here. We begin to see it. We begin to make it conscious. And when we make something conscious, the next time it comes, that consciousness comes with it. And we untie a little more of that knot. Now that's very different than to say you want to get over this particular reaction. Wanting to get over something doesn't help us understand it one bit. In fact, it makes it an obstacle that is blocking some clear journey that I'm on. But the journey is the journey of understanding, not the journey to get somewhere after we can surmount this obstacle. And so what we do is we just, everything that comes up, that's it. That's where the journey's end ends. Right there, okay, this is it. It was interesting, as I mentioned at IMS at a board meeting and this weekend, and they hired some diversity trainers to come and give us 3 hours of training on our board, for the board. And they showed us a movie of about 10 women who sat around. They're each of different ethnic groups. Two Caucasian women, but everyone else in the group had a variety of different backgrounds, Native American or Hindu or Muslim or all kinds of different Asian Americans and Mexican Americans, on and on. And each of them brought their own pain to the situation and were communicating that pain. And I saw that Because most of the conversation had a kind of a frustration and irritation at the white women, because most of the people there, being of ethnic diverse backgrounds, felt that they didn't have equal power to the white women who were there. And I thought the dialogue was a good one. It wasn't explosive or anything. I thought it was an important dialogue to have, but I could also see that it was never going to resolve itself in inclusivity. Because what was really happening, as I could see it, was that the women were attempting to gain their share of power, not to find the absolute place of equality. And that the white women were caught in the shame of the shame of their race, really, and having felt that they had done, and their race had done, the things that these women were claiming, which, of course, the white race has done it. But from that sense of shame and from the opposing sense of argument and wanting to regain the women's power, they were missing each other somehow. There wasn't a real communication. There wasn't a real meeting. And I thought, well, you know, it's very important for this to occur. I'm not in any way suggesting that that kind of dialogue shouldn't occur. But if something else is required of us here to really come and meet each other, not as black or white or brown or yellow or whatever, but as human beings, how can we see each other so that it doesn't matter what ethnicity means, because it still mattered to each of them? And that's what the inclusive heart is really attempting to do. It's attempting to spread out beyond the internal contrast and dialogues of comparison and evaluation and judgment that we all bring into our life. It needs a different base in which to look upon the world, not the basis of the mind. The mind only knows difference. It only can perceive differences. But if this conversation and that conversation had come from the heart, if it had come from the expression of something that unifies us and which we just have misperceived, then I think there's a different kind of resolution that this culture and all cultures could bring to itself. My hope is that our change of leadership has that in its focus. I'm very hopeful that we can begin that dialogue of absolute equality. That's my hope. So the heart sets boundaries for the love of the limited. For the love of the limited. It doesn't disapprove of the limitations that each of us feel, and the ways that we are still trying to contrast and compare and judge ourselves throughout our living experience. It has patience with that. It has love for that process and the resolution of that process. And it brings forth the light of its own attention and willingness to observe towards that resolution of spirit. Seems to me that that has something to do with the holiday season that we're in, does it not? To know the difference between the know of the mind and the know of the heart. And to feel where that know is coming from. And the know of the mind will always carry some judgment with it, some comparison with it, some sense of propriety and hurt and pain and argument with it. And the know of the heart is just simply saying that now is not the time to push ourselves beyond our own boundary. Stay yet within our boundary. Remain there. Just be patient with it. Just be willing to observe it, and it will dissolve on its own. It need not have our feel the whip of our impatience. Just the quiet gentleness of our attention is enough. The limited needs time and it needs space for it to move to the unlimited. And sometimes it needs the wisdom of retreating back into ourselves, of pulling back, of avoidance. We call this wise avoidance. When it's just too much is going on here. It's that idealization that we have to recognize as the no of the mind. When it says, I shouldn't be better than this. I've been practicing for 10 years and I'm still caught in this. I should have gone over this before. My heart should be more embracing of these people. And as soon as we say that, we're not willing to look at our prejudice. As soon as we think we should, after all these years, be over any kind of prejudice or opinions about anyone or ourselves at all, that we should be full of self-love, then we're going to have only disdain for those areas that are still holding on to the prejudice. And we aren't willing to examine it. And so, in fact, that disdain is just more self-prejudice. So this, doing away with this idealization of the Dharma, and just being, I mean, really just bringing that persevering attention, and with a stark honesty to admit what it sees. Yeah, I said it. I did it. I feel that. I can't help it. I felt it. It's there. You feel it in you. But that isn't a call to whitewash it. Let's say, what's going on here? We ask a question about it. We bring it out. We call it out of its cave. What's going on here? What's happening in this moment that makes me feel so reactive inside or so opinionated about something? What's going on here? The willingness to ask an innocent question is the heart calling it out, calling out. It doesn't demand us to eliminate the boundary. It wants to know what that boundary is, what that feeling that just occurred was. What's in there? In fact, you develop a love of the boundary. A love of the boundary. It's like setting limitations for a young child, not to run out in the street. You say no. And they don't have the cognitive maturity to understand why. They may cry and scream. They want the ball that's going out in the street. And in the same way, the parent gently takes the child and brings him or her inside. But that sense of no is the resounding confidence of maturity. And that's the no of love. Or if I'm in an abusive relationship, and we have to be very careful with this because oftentimes we wish to stay in an abusive relationship thinking we're deserving of the pain that's being inflicted upon us. And from the mind's point of view, that neurotic need to be blamed or to be punished for what the person we think we are, the character we think we are, could stay in an abusive relationship. But the heart knows that something is amiss here. Now, which are we going to listen to? The yes of the mind to stay or the no of the heart? This is not. Even if our emotional body wants to stay in the relationship, and oftentimes there is a very strong attachment to self-punishment because of the deep sense of unworthiness most of us carry. But the heart says no to that. If you really listen, there's a strong no in there. This isn't right. I'm out of here. That's the no of love. And this is very important. Because I had somebody come to me in an interview one time and make this very point. And she said that she was staying in an abusive relationship because she heard that the practice was being with things as they are. Being with things as they are is different than resigning to things being the way they are. Let me say that again. Being with things as they are is different than resigning to things being the way they are. And we get that confused. That's again, we get that confused. The situation is working for us. And we feel, well, just be with things as they are, you know, that anything is workable. And there's this enormous feeling inside that there's injustice here. But we don't listen to that because we think that the practice is just being able to open and be inclusive even to this pain that's coming my way. All this abuse that's occurring. Nonsense. Nonsense. That's not the heart. That's the mind. I love this... Martin Luther King quote, because I think it shows very clearly that being with things as they are is not a call towards inaction. He said, we will match your capacity to inflict suffering, speaking to the white race, with our capacity to endure suffering. We will meet your physical force with soul force. We will not hate you, but we cannot in all good conscience obey your unjust laws. But we will soon wear you down with our capacity to suffer. And in winning our freedom, we will so appeal to your heart and consciousness that we will win yours in the process. So if just being with things as they are, Rosa Parks would have just sat in the back of the bus, wouldn't she? But no, this is not right. So it's not a call to inactivity, to being passively resigned to the situation at hand, but to let the heart speak about whether what's going on here in discernment and clarity. And then moving in accordance with that. You see, we can get caught up in the phraseology of the Dharma. In the sense that a phrase kind of catches us and we think, okay, now I'm just going to master that phrase in relationship to my orientation to Dharma. And never realize that When we aren't listening moment to moment to how the heart speaks, because the heart doesn't just, if the heart continually speaks to us in an ongoing way, and I don't mean through language necessarily, though oftentimes it does, but sometimes just through the discerning awareness, just through the discriminating wisdom, and then responding to what we see, rather than to some principle that we think holds the whole of the Dharma, like being with things as they are. So just, no matter what happens, I'll just be with them as they are. That's resignation, that's not heart. Love doesn't resign itself to division. So this constant willingness to work towards balancing the situation, the balance between yes and no, of being open and feeling what's occurring and then responding appropriately to what's occurring. This balance between what I need to do to embrace the situation and the limits of my ability to move beyond those boundaries. And feeling the edge within oneself without idealization. And also balance between the sense of what I need in this moment and what the situation is calling for in this moment. So that I'm not overextending myself because I think I should be more available to others than to my own needs. Sometimes that's called burnout, by the way. If you overextend beyond your own needs without looking at the balanced relationship between those two, we can idealize what we should be doing in a situation, but not fully accept the limitation of what we are going through as a human being, as an individual. And that needs some self-correction. We need to look at that. We don't discard ourselves. We don't discard the I to get to we. We look at the limitations of I to get to we. And as we work with those limitations, it opens to we. And this sense of idealism or perfectionism that you just think if you try hard enough that and you know that everything will work out, or that unrealistically high expectations and standards on things. It's just look. This don't bring all that stuff to it. You get a sense of whether you move forward or backward, whether you embrace or whether what needs to happen, but we do it all as consciously as we can. No idealization in this world, no idealization of the heart. Realizing the limits, being gentle with those limits, breathing life into those, not trying to get over our limitations, but to see them, to recognize them. The sense of helping and serving. The difference is, of course, when you try to help someone, it's often from the sense of one's own need to be connected through a helping role. That's very different than serving someone as equals. And each of these words holds a key to the total inclusion of the heart. The I and the we. So the love of others without the love of oneself forces a loss of that external boundary before we have completed our internal work. So that sense of love of oneself is so important. It's such a foundation for us to advance forward in this. And many of us are driven by the sense that we want to get over ourselves, not love ourselves. There's no repose in stillness. There's no quietude in wanting to get over ourselves. And wherever there's creating some kind of irritation and inward resistance, that's where we look. That's where we go. That's where our mind is drawn. And if we find, you know, if we don't love ourselves, then we try to, what we try to do is to discover, we search for intimacy in others. Because we have no sense of self-intimacy. And if we are without self-love, we seek then attention of others to give us some sense of self-confirmation. Since we won't give it ourselves, we'll look for it through other people's attention to me. You see, these are all signs of being out of balance. Let's look at this thing. Let's just be honest here. Okay, now why am I seeking attention to others? Because in that moment, there may well be some self-disorientation, some way that I am self-criticizing or negating myself. See, attention has to be served. The heart needs the attention. It needs the confirmation. It needs awareness. It needs to be fully realized. And the way the mind works that system is it says, well, if you know, since I don't love myself, I'll find that sense of awareness and attention and consciousness and showing off or doing something demonstrative so other people pay attention to me. Because attention is what confirms that I'm alive. And these are signs. I'm out of balance here. There's something going on. Let me look at this. Through love of I, we interconnect. Through love of I, we interconnect. And so in meditation, we go down and we feel the pain of something. Or perhaps it's like a surgical incision. And we just, through quiet, through patience, we come to a boundary, we come to an eruption, we come to some discord in ourselves. And we can just be patient and observe that. And oftentimes there's an eruption of energy or emotion or something is unlocked in that moment of attention. And like a scuba diver, once we have felt that shift in ourselves, we rise slowly and pause along the way. When we have gone down and done such deep work sometime in our meditation, we don't come rising up to the surface. We follow our slowest bubble. And we pause along the way. And that pausing allows us to heal to what it is that we just saw. We don't rush to the surface. And that pause is not contrary to the work. It is the work. That pause of the heart that allows the necessary time for the healing to occur to what we just saw is the work. And slowly then we rise up, very naturally. And we then look at this thing called me that has taken on a new shine, a new beauty from the pain it's just seen in itself. Not demanding perfection, but seeing the beauty of this new realization. This new understanding. And we pause there. Very gently. And then we may go down again. And that's the way it works. Not through force of will. Not through keeping ourselves at some kind of forced, but gently, the heart's way, the heart's movement. After pain, we relearn our beauty. And sometimes that takes time because of what we just saw about ourselves. When we see ourselves as selfish and as egocentric and as hated or as hate or an enormous sense of inadequacy. We have to spend a little time letting that reframe itself in terms of its own beauty. Because if we react too quickly to it, we'll try to go down and do more surgery long before we've healed to the first wound. And so the willingness to allow a gentle quiet and we learn our own beauty is very much that inclusivity of heart. And a deeper sense of ease begins to show itself. Because we have been easy with ourselves the whole way. Unrushed, unhurried, acknowledging human flaws as human flaws. We descend again to look again. to see again. And we develop a very firm understanding of the no to our story. Because with each time we descend, the story flourishes in its drama, in its acrimony, in its accusation. And we allow all that to sort of air itself, asking very deeply whether thought ever holds the truth of anything. And whether, knowing if we follow this story, it will just lead to greater pain in ourselves and between ourselves and others. And being willing to hold the pain without the blame in the total inclusion of the heart. Thank you all. Can we sit for a moment or two? Just sitting. The more we're willing to see and the less we do anything about what we see, the better. So if there are any questions or comments about anything, I'd be happy to. Yes. Yes.
And so that I feel criticism and sometimes it's information I need to know, and I'll feel the shame and then I'll tell myself, well, just get over the shame, or I don't rest with those very difficult feelings. And so what you said was quite helpful.
She's talking about shame and criticism. She doesn't rest very easily with shame. She wants to get over the shame, right? I don't know if I mentioned here, I don't know, I've done so much speaking in the last week. I can't remember who I spoke to and what I said, but the moments in which we see where we're not up to the inclusion of the heart, the total inclusion, where we're still bickering with ourselves, where we still have some disagreement. You see, that is the mind coming in, weighing in on its judgment. It's weighing in on its with its idealism, right? It's coming over with its sense of comparison and how well you're doing, and you haven't gotten over the shame, and it's been with, you know, all of that sort of thing. So you can see the mind's tool there. Now, the heart is a different organ, and therefore a different dimension. It doesn't hold itself accountable to getting over anything. The sun doesn't hold itself accountable to getting over you so that it can shine on someone else, does it? And so sometimes it's helpful to use something like the sun or the air as a metaphor for my own awareness. How is the air holding me right now? It's not blowing past me to get through me to something, right? It's just holding me. It's just that is a different dimension. If you have to be very quiet. The sun is very quiet. I mean, it's not making or weighing in with any disparaging comments about what it sees. It just sees. It just reveals, doesn't it? Okay. So what does it look like what does awareness look like? It's a good investigation for each of us to pursue. What does awareness look like when awareness just reveals? You see, now we say, okay, now wait a minute, it's not revealing, you know, I'm judging this, or I've got an opinion about it. That isn't it. So we have to be quieter. Because the only thing we can do is to stop talking. Right? So we bring less noise to the awareness. And then there's a crucial threshold in which that awareness takes us out of the dimension of the mind and into the dimension of it being surrounded by it. It suddenly, it surrounds us. We're not instrumental in even accessing it. We sort of step through this gate in which we're applying attention to the shame. And at a crucial point, and just through our willingness to be quiet with the shame, suddenly awareness is surrounding the whole of us, including the shame, much like the sense of the air is doing right now. And you get a sense of this dynamic, this thing called awareness, pre-existing our efforts to get through the shame. Because as long as we are looking at it through the mind, there will be disagreement with what it sees. There'll be comparison with what it sees. And that's the nature of the organ. The nature of the mind is that it looks in terms of distance, how far I've come, how far I have yet to go. And so if we're using that form of awareness to come to absolute allowance, we aren't going to find it there. We're just going to find more disagreement. So we have to be quieter and quieter. There's nothing wrong. It's just that we're not quiet enough for this other dimension to come and it completely embrace us. Do you see? So it's very important, just like you did, Nancy, to see that there's nothing wrong with what you've done. You've just been locked into a particular battle with yourself. Now, the quieter you become, the less resistance you're going to have to that shame, the more the shame is going to show you what it is. And it's going to feel shameful. You're not going to get out of feeling it. Okay, which is very important to understand. But then you become, as you get quieter, you also it shows it to you in spades. But it doesn't have the chokehold of identification that pulls me down with it, you see? And so I can look at it, but it becomes much more impersonal in the looking. And yes, it becomes much more demonstrative in what it shows me, but it's not as personal, and so therefore it's not as bad, you might say. As long as I'm engaged with it in the mind, I've got some tension related to what I see, and there's a dialogue between what I see and who I am that sees it, and that dialogue is always trying to reconcile me having to have it. And there is no reconciliation to that, except the complete dropping of the sense of the ownership of the person who thinks they have it, which will come naturally as we become quiet with it. Okay. Good luck to you, dear. And may I say that the way you're moving is exactly the way a person becomes conscious. The way that the unconscious becomes conscious. Okay? So you're not doing anything wrong. So this is the way. This is the movement. This is it. This is how each of us that I know of within this tradition move into full conscious attention. Okay. Anyone else? Yes, sir.
If I put my hand up, I can't really think what I want to say. It's in my mind somewhere.
That's okay. Just take your time.
I feel that in this inclusivity, if there's things that don't seem to clear up, even though you're being included, and maybe I'm not being that inclusive, I sort of have the great obligation to sort of dwell on things that are there, that are painful, rather than say, recently I've been thinking, maybe I shouldn't dwell on it all the time, maybe
right.
I go to something else.
Right, good. The man says, he was talking about sometimes whatever the experience is, he dwells on it. And you think, well, maybe I shouldn't be dwelling on this. Maybe I should. That's a very important point. And let me show you how that works. First of all, when we dwell upon something, we have a story about it. You know, we're caught up in a kind of historical pattern with it, don't we? And the dwelling isn't just the seeing, it's an accompanying narrative, commentary about it. And that isn't very helpful. We're not fully oriented or aligned or addressing what it is that's there. We're kind of bringing in some of our idealism and some of our, you know, self-judgment along those lines. When we realize we're doing that, we really need to readdress this thing in a completely different way. Okay, come on. You know, you have to snap to a cold shower approach. All right. Now full frontal address here, where you're feeling this thing from head to foot, and you're going to be completely quiet in relationship to what you see. You're going to let it tell you what it is. You've been telling it what it is from your past. Now it can tell you what it is. To do that, you have to be very quiet if you want to get to know it, don't you? No added commentary whatsoever. That's just arguing. So you want to, I absolutely want to know what this is. And not kind of hedging your bets and when am I going to get over this. If you think in terms of time, you're being impatient with it. Impatience is a time-centered approach. How much longer do I? Huh? This does not, we're not looking to get over it. We're looking to understand it. To understand it, I have to fully embrace it. That's why, and the only reason, I'd be quiet with it. Do you see? So it requires a new approach. Now, as it begins, sometimes these patterns can go on long, long periods. And they keep coming back up. And you go, I've seen this 1,000 times. It will dawn on you at one point, why am I spending so much time focused on this? It's as almost as if I give it new energy when I focus on it being so important, you know. I got to catch that thing. It's like that. And now I'll do all the right, you know. But that need. It's like, what does it say? Like trying to catch every cloud in the sky. It's like, so what if it's there? Now we have had to do a lot of work to get to the point where we actually emotionally, we have the emotional intelligence to say, so what if it's there? I don't have to focus, I don't have to laser beam in on it every time it shows itself because that's creating its own importance. Right? And at some point, it's there and it doesn't matter that it's there. In the wider scale of things, it doesn't confiscate our attention because who cares? It doesn't say anything. The reason that we catch it with such fervor is because we think it says something or going to say something that's going to be important. But you know after a certain point of time that it's not. It's just nonsense, right? And then you're available in ways that you never could have been. See, so you'll see that you still believe it's something dramatic in your life, then this is going to give you the gist of the story of all the things that are wrong with you. So I have to look, you know, I have to look at this emotion. No, it's not. It's going to give you the emotional story. That's all. Won't give you anything else. Right? So, no big deal. Now, awareness can spread much beyond the boundary of this, that particular. It's like, it's available. It's available for other things. It's available for life. It's available for joy. It's available for heart. Yes.
You said something about serving others as equals.
Yes.
And that really struck me. I do a lot of volunteer work, and people can't And I always say something like, it does more for me than it does for you. And I thought, then that means I'm probably not serving them as equals.
No. She's talking about serving and helping. You know, when I was in hospice care, I got involved in hospice care because I was interested in the dying. I was interested in what it was like to die. Right? It was serving me to be with them. I was learning about something that seemed very important. And in that willingness to pay attention and to be open to the process, then help came, or service came in that relationship. And so, but if I had gotten involved, the dying need me, right? The poor need me. That's an orientation of pity. It's an orientation of promoting oneself at the expense of another. This is balance. You should be felt. You should feel like you're getting replenished. It should give you energy to be with those in service. Service work gives you energy. Helping depletes your energy. It's a good rule of thumb. Because you're learning, you're growing. Like, my God, tell me what it's like to die. You know, like, I really want to know. And you're interested in the person, you're interested in the process, you're interested in the whole thing, and you're growing in relationship to that, you see? And so, be very careful, you know, that that we don't weigh in on the wrong side of this equation. I need to help. I mean, that's just, you don't need to, people don't need you. Right? They don't need you. You may need them. Okay, all. Thank you. Leave you on that fair note.